It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear the tall tale of Clifford Thompson, the tallest Wisconsinite who ever lived. That's in today's edition of Wisconsin Legends.
First, more than 750 hospitals around the nation could be facing penalties as the federal government cracks down on patient injuries and infections. That's based on recently released data from the government and analyzed for Kaiser Health News.
65 hospitals made the list in Wisconsin, though many will probably avoid penalty, according to the latest report from the Wisconsin Hospital Association.
Joining us now to talk about the possible infractions and how we got here is Jordan Rao, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So more than 750 hospitals across the nation are facing possible penalties due to patient injuries and infections. This is part of the Affordable Care Act. Can you give us a sense of what kinds of problems this is trying to address?
Well, infections are a major problem in hospitals around the country. Even though rates have been dropping, they're still very high. And we're seeing new crops of infections and bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. So it's a growing problem, as well as you have problems such as slips and falls and blood clots and bed sores, basically things where patients come into the hospital and they end up leaving worse than they were when they came in.
And what kinds of penalties are we talking about?
The government is going to, of all the hospitals that it assesses, it's going to take the quarter hospitals that are worse, and it's going to reduce their payments through Medicare by 1% over the course of a year starting in October. So every time a Medicare patient comes in for, say, a knee replacement, the hospital's only going to get 99% of payment for that. So it's, while it's not going to knock hospitals out of business, that certainly is a ding on the bottom line that's intended to really focus the attention not just of doctors and nurses, but also the hospital leaderships, board of trustees, investors, whoever, on the importance of cutting down on complications and infections.
Now, as I understand it, these are preliminary results. Does this mean that some of the hospitals that showed up on this list could still kind of clean up their act and escape penalty?
Yeah, the preliminary numbers are based on two-thirds of the total data that will be used. There's one more year of infection data that the government needs to factor in. So it's still pretty fluid. Now, if you're the way that they do it is they give every hospital a score from 1 to 10. If you're really, really high on there, 9 or 10, it's going to be very unlikely that those hospitals are going to avoid being penalized. And likewise, if your score is very, very low, say, below a 5, it's quite likely that you're going to stay that way because, for the most part, infections don't change that much over time rates. However, in a lot of these cases, you're actually dealing with fairly small numbers of infections and complications, so one or two could knock a hospital over the line one way or the other.
Yeah, how are hospitals being measured on this?
They're being measured on there are two major types of infections that they're being measured on. One are called CLABSIs, and these are infections from central lines or catheters that are put into veins. And hospitals use these regularly to pump in saline or chemotherapy or antibiotics into patients. And often these become sort of freeways of infections because bacteria will get in and go straight into the bloodstream. So that's one. The second one is called a CAUTI, and it's a catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And these are catheters that are directed into the bladder, and they remove urine. And so that's, obviously important when patients aren't able to get up and go to the bathroom. So those are the two major things that the government is looking at. But they're also looking at, as I mentioned, a bunch of other adverse events, like slips and falls and lacerations during surgery.
Now, it sounds like some of the major teaching hospitals may be more vulnerable because, I guess, of the large amount of things that they go there and maybe conflicting priorities. Can you give a sense of what the teaching hospitals are up against?
One of the surprising results of of our look at the preliminary penalties was the huge proportion of teaching hospitals that received them, 54% nationwide. And again, this is, you know, overall, it's just a quarter of hospitals that would get them, but 54% are teaching hospitals. And so that's raised a lot of questions. On the one hand, is it possible that there's something wrong with these measures, that they're not taking into account the relative sickness of patients, or the fact that these hospitals just tend to do more things where patients need catheters, for instance? Or on the other hand, is there something fundamentally flawed about teaching hospitals, that they don't place as much attention on patient safety, that they're distracted, that, you know, in the midst of, you know, having residents round and dealing with a lot of very, very complex research, that they're sort of neglecting the most simple things? And these are very, very hotly debated and I think unresolved questions.
UW Health here in Madison, Wisconsin, is on that preliminary list as an example of one of these big teaching hospitals. We also have a number of smaller hospitals, rural hospitals. How is it going to affect them?
Well, the most rural hospitals, the ones that are designated as critical access hospitals by the government, are exempted from this program, so they won't be affected at all in this year. In the future, they might be factored in, but right now they're left out. But there are community hospitals. There's a total of 65 hospitals in Wisconsin that are eligible for the penalties. And of those, about 35% were designated as having the preliminary penalties. And that's a very high proportion compared to other states. And whether that is something particular to Wisconsin hospitals or if it's just sort of the luck of the draw with running these numbers and it's sort of statistical noise isn't clear.
Is there any danger that some hospitals could try to underreport their numbers of infections or other instances of hospital harm to escape notice and avoid penalties?
That's a great question, and it's always possible. There has been some concern that some states that mandate reporting of infections, that the infection rates are higher than others. But for some of this stuff, first of all, a third of it is based on Medicare billing records, so there's not as much leeway, and there are significant penalties if you underreport. And then the other information is surveillance infection rates as reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so, you know, to avoid the penalty, you're sort of engaging in a fairly significant government, you know, I hesitate to say conspiracy, but, you know, something that's unethical and potentially illegal. So I sort of wonder whether for that it's worth the risk for any hospital to really avoid reporting these.
Would you say that this is driven largely by concern about some of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are out there and costs, or is it something else?
It is part of, I mean, there's certainly a lot of it that's concerned with the antibiotic-resistant bacteria and for the amount of damage that is done to patients. I mean, 1 in 8 patients suffers a hospital-acquired condition, you know, something that was potentially avoidable. So that is a major concern. And then more broadly, it's about steering the gigantic ship of Medicare payment in a different way, because historically Medicare has paid just a flat fee for each hospital, no matter how your patient turns out. You know, I mean, they adjust it for what the patient is in there for and how sick they might be and such like that. But you get the, you know, it's sort of like lawyers, you know, you just get, you know, you do a great job, you win the case, you lose the case, you get paid the same way. And so that's something that everyone is, or not everyone, but a lot of policy people aren't happy with. And so this is part of a broader move to say, you know what, we're going to start paying our hospitals and then eventually our doctors and nursing homes and all our healthcare providers. We're going to take into account what good a job they do when we're paying them, and maybe that'll incentivize them to pay a lot more attention to quality and a bit less to the bottom line.
And so far, patient advocacy groups, they're happy with this. But what about the hospitals and medical community in general? What are they saying, especially some of these institutions that have been red flagged for now?
I would say they're going through the Kubler-Ross 7 stages of grief and denial. You know, there's some that see this coming. I mean, it's been in law since 2010 and are just sort of resigned to it. There are some that feel that have been way ahead of the curve anyway when to curb infections and conditions, which obviously expose them to malpractice and to fines, as well as to having to pay, you know, costs to take care of the problems. And then there are others that are really, really unhappy, that feel that the program is unfair because even if your rates are lower, going down, you can still be penalized. You're just being compared to everybody else. That the for all the stuff that you and I have been talking about, that it may not be a level playing field. And so they're, you know, just angry and displeased.
Now, there are some reports that, in general, rates of infection are falling. So why do we need this now?
Well, some of it was, I mean, the latest reports have had that for some these types of accidents, they are going down. Surgical site infections, for instance, were down 20% over a four-year period. But in others, they're pretty flat. In terms of the urinary tract infections, they've actually crept up a little bit. And as we've mentioned, there's not just infections that are antibiotic resistant like MRSA and C. diff that are coming, but an even worse strain that there's no known cure or treatment for that are becoming of increased worry. So even though they may be dropping, they're still not at the bottom. And then the other thing is that for a lot of this stuff, the view is that they really are preventable, that if you follow pretty clear protocols about how to handle a catheter and sterilization and when to remove it, which is earlier rather than later, you should be able to avoid most of these things.
Jordan, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Jordan Rau, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News.
Garrison Keillor always says us folks in the Midwest are hardy and above average. Today we take a look at a man who really took that to a whole different level.
Clifford Thompson was one of the tallest men who ever lived and was most certainly the tallest man ever to call Wisconsin home. During his lifetime, he had many careers, from a circus performer to a practicing lawyer and plenty of other ventures in between. Today on Wisconsin Legends, we learn more about the big man and his connection to the state.
Here to help us do that is Ashley Steinbrink. She's a writer and graphic designer at Who Knew, an arts and culture website covering Northeast Wisconsin. She recently wrote a piece that took a closer look at the life of Clifford Thompson. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
All right. Well, let's start with the basics here. Just how tall was Clifford Thompson?
Well, there's been a little bit of controversy on the subject of his actual height, but he claimed he was 8'7", 8 feet 7 inches.
Wow.
Pretty tall. I thought 6 feet was tall. So, but the other people say, you know, he was 7'5". There was a researcher named Craig Elbert who more recently used photo analysis to determine his size was somewhere between 8'3" and 8'6". But, you know, that's common, I guess, among giants to exaggerate their size a bit, maybe wear taller shoes and a taller hat, and, you know, circuses, which he spent a lot of his life. They specialize in illusions, so who knows? But I kind of go toward the photo analysis one, somewhere between 8'3" and 8'6", but he probably knew best.
And he said that there wasn't anything in particular medically going on with him. He didn't have any sort of hormonal or glandular issue. He was just... You descended from Vikings, pretty much.
Yeah, he had that Norwegian blood, and yep, he wanted people to know it was nothing to do with any kind of condition or health issue. He was 12 pounds when he was born. His family, his mom and dad, were normal height. His dad was 5'10", his mom was 5'9". He had two younger sisters who were average height. He didn't stop growing until he was 27. So,
just kept growing.
He just kept growing.
He was born, I understand, in North Dakota, but spent a lot of his life in Wisconsin. Can you tell us some about his early days here in the state?
Sure, yeah. He moved, his family actually owned a dairy farm in Scandinavia, Wisconsin, which is sort of near Iowa. And, you know, it was 7 years old, I believe, when he came from North Dakota. So he had a pretty normal childhood, I guess. He went to school, and he tried out for the basketball team, but he actually didn't make it. I think it was because of they were worried about injuries and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you would think he'd be really good on the basketball team. I don't know. He lived a pretty normal childhood. Then he kind of got into the circus. He did that for 12 years. After he graduated, he wanted to be a teacher. He wanted to teach high school math and science, but he actually struggled to get a job in that profession. I guess he just assumed that the superintendents who rejected him were nervous that he would frighten the children. So
Yeah, this is a guy who had he had a lot of different lives as he went along. It seemed as though he started, you know, with one thing, the circus, and wanted to be a teacher. And, you know, maybe inevitably he ended up in Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, he kind of got a little bit frustrated with the whole teacher thing. He spent a year applying for different positions there. And that's sort of when he decided to do the circus thing. To become a professional giant, and that worked out for him for 12 years doing that. And one of the circuses, it was the Barnes Circus, their headquarters was in Los Angeles, so that's kind of how he came into the movie scene, the Hollywood films. He was, you know, known to be the largest man in any, appearing in any movies, the tallest man to ever appear in Hollywood movies, I think is what the Chicago Tribune said. So in 1931, there was an article on that. So, yeah, he was in several movies. He was in A Day in the Life of a Giant. I don't know that anyone's going to be really familiar with some of these 1930 movies, but Movie Town, Sealskins was one of the more popular ones, and The 20th Century. So,
and I got to say, it's not really enough to talk about him. You have to see him in a way to believe him, and we've got a video that we'll be posting on the Central Time Facebook page. He really is remarkable. He looks huge. He doesn't look like a normal human being.
Yeah, no, I mean, his shoe size was 22. Can you imagine having that large of a shoe? Everything had to be custom made. The only thing that he didn't have to have custom made was his necktie. Otherwise, his hat, his shirts, pants, everything. His chest was 46 inches across. On his ring finger, you could fit a half dollar right through it. So imagine having a finger, your ring finger, as big as a 50-cent piece and, you know, He had to have a 19-inch extension added to the steering wheel on his car. He drove a 1935 Ford sedan, and he actually had to have those front seats removed, and he sat in the back seat with that 19-inch extension to be able to reach the steering wheel. So that attracted about as much attention as he did.
And I imagine a lot of the attention he got was maybe unfriendly or at least joking about his height. In researching the story, did you get a sense of how he dealt with that, how he felt about that?
You know, I think he had a pretty good attitude most of the time about his height. I know that he got a little bit annoyed by some comments that he heard often, like, how's the weather up there? He got frustrated by people that would ask him stuff like that. And he was really just, his biggest fear was getting his head chopped off by one of those four-bladed ceiling fans. So living a life like a giant, you know, I mean, it's not normal, that's for sure, but he had a good attitude about it.
And he was a really handsome guy, so handsome, in fact, that he ended up being a spokesman for Blatt's Beer.
For what? What
for a beer company, right?
Yes, actually. After he just felt like he wanted to do something else with his life, so he just kind of quit the circus. They weren't that happy with him, the employers, when he quit. That was when he was in the Cole Brothers Circus. But he just felt like he needed to do something that required more skills, so he tried to be a spokesperson in Milwaukee, and he did some car commercials for Ford. I think it was something like the Ford V8 is roomy enough for a giant. And he also was a spokesperson for the Big Shoe Store in Stevens Point. But during that time, the Wisconsin milk industry actually hired him to walk around at the Wisconsin State Fair. And he was wearing a sign that said, "Drink milk, look what it did for me," you know. And that's when Blatt's Brewery, which is actually Pabst Brewery in Milwaukee now, it later became Pabst, but that's when they saw him and just kind of joked around him that he should be wearing a sign for beer instead of milk. And he kind of took it seriously. It was that same night of the Wisconsin State Fair that he went to the offices of the brewery and talked with them about being the spokesperson there. And that's how he ended up landing that job. And he did that for several years. I think it was 4 years he was a salesman for that company.
All that, and he did a stint as a lawyer, too. He got his law degree.
That's right. Well, after all this travel, and things started to get rough for him after a little while because, you know, at this point he was 460 pounds. He was walking with a cane, because that was a lot easier. All the travel kind of got to him a little bit. They were traveling 40,000 miles every year, him and his wife. And this was his second wife now. His first wife, I guess, divorced him because, well, she said it was because she was sick of making his large meals, his
All right.
very extra large meals. But
we'll leave it there for now. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us and sharing his story with us today.
Yeah, no problem at all.
That's Ashley Steinbrink. She's a writer and graphic designer at Who Knew? That's an arts and culture website covering Northeast Wisconsin. First, we take a look at the future of a sport that people seem to love, hate, or in some cases love to hate. For years now, the game of golf has been plagued by declining participation, high costs, courses closing, and a lack of new golfers getting into the game. For some golf fans, there's a concern that without some kind of change, the game could become more or less obsolete in the not-so-distant future.
And that hasn't escaped the attention of the Professional Golfers Association of America, or PGA. The organization recently launched a task force to find ways to attract new golfers and get lapsed golfers out on the course again. But with golf being a game deeply rooted in tradition, what are the possibilities of change, and can it be done while preserving the sport that's lasted for hundreds of years?
Ashley Mayo is one of the members on that task force. She joins us now to talk about golf's current situation and some of the ideas being floated to freshen up the game. Ashley's also a senior editor at Golf Digest magazine. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we just mentioned there are a lot of concerns that golf might be on the decline. What's your assessment? What is the state of golf today?
I think all of these concerns are a little bit inflated. The first quarter of the year happened to be a very cold, long winter. And
true.
So, you know, all those kind of statistics that said, you know, golf was on the decline, rounds played were less than they were last year. I mean, golf is an outdoor sport. It's very much dependent on the weather. And so, you know, this kind of idea that golf is dying couldn't be farther from the truth. And also the idea that we've lost 5 million golfers over the last 3 years. Well, we haven't accounted. No one talks about the 5 million that have come into the game. So, while golf hasn't necessarily grown over the past 3 or 4 years, it has not declined.
Well, it's the PGA is at least concerned enough to start this task force to figure out ways to start new golfers. You're part of that. There is at least a recognition that, hey, maybe we need to reach out to bring some new people into the game.
Well, this task force has been kind of wrongfully pegged as something that will help save the game from dying. And it's not. It's just a task force of people, getting people together to think of cool ideas and to come up with neat ideas. Even if something's not broken, you kind of have to keep it fresh and revive it. So we're just getting together and meeting to talk about ways to, keep golf fresh and keep it interesting, not necessarily because it needs to be saved from anything. I can't think of any other sport that has two monthlies, two weeklies, and an entire television network devoted to it. Golf is very healthy.
So what accounts then for the health of golf as you see it? You're saying it's thriving despite a lot of attention in the media to maybe a decline. What accounts for it doing so well?
I'm not saying it's thriving. I'm just not saying it's not on life support, so many people might think it is. It's not. Some of the things that we're doing on this task force are thinking of ways to make golf more accessible. So one of the big hurdles with golf and getting golfers to become, or people to become golfers, is convincing them that, you know, golf is worth the time and the money that it demands. Well, what if it didn't demand 18 holes, or, you know, 4 hours of someone's time, or, you know, the money required to play 18 holes? What if golf was a six-hole round, or meant three holes, or it meant 12 holes? So we're trying to come up with ways, first of all, to get people to accept the idea that if they play three holes, it means that they did play golf, or if they play six holes, it means they played golf. And also we're trying to think of ways to convince golf courses to offer six-hole rates and 12-hole rates. That's all important.
Well, one of the old cliches, and I'm thinking back to 1950s comic strips and beyond, is the frustrated golfer smashing their clubs because they, you know, they can't sink that putt. Is there talk of making an option to make it easier maybe for kids entering the sport or first timers to avoid that level of frustration and keep them coming back?
To avoid frustration. Golf is it's a tough sport. You know, it requires a lot of technical kind of things. You know, it's a very technical sport. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, is just going to be tough. And it's also one of the kind of beauties of the game. You know, it's not easy. And the challenge is what keeps people, some people coming back. But yes, it also frustrates other people to no end. And so, you know, besides the fact, I guess to get juniors involved, you know, there are family tees. So these are, you know, tee markers that are set up in the fairway at a lot of resort-friendly kind of destinations. And, you know, there's this idea of that 15-inch cup that the PGA of America and TaylorMade are experimenting with, which is, you know, four times larger than the standard golf hole. And it's just a lot of fun to play. So, yes, there are ways in which people in the industry are trying to make golf easier.
Now, golf is a game rooted in a lot of tradition. What's been the range of reactions to the ideas of having an option, maybe for first-timers, of a larger hole like that 15-inch hole?
Mm-hmm. The 15-inch hole is never meant to replace the standard hole. It's just meant to be an alternative to the standard hole. So, you know, while the traditional – this idea is not marketed toward traditionalists, you know traditional golfers are very happy with the sport, and we're not afraid of losing them at all. This idea is geared toward that golfer who is frustrated and who's looking for something that's a little easier and more fun and quicker. So, you know, the two holes can coexist on the same green, and, you know, the traditional golfer can just continue on with his or her own game and play with a golfer who is a little more of a beginner and needs that kind of more forgiveness. So, for example, I played golf, foot golf on Tuesday.
Foot golf?
Yeah, it's kind of like combining soccer with golf. And the soccer, kind of the foot golf holes were on the same golf course as a regular golf course, you know. So golfers were playing through us while we were playing foot golf. Me and my foursome were playing foot golf. So, you know, you can kind of coexist on the same in the same platform, you know, in the same space. But we did our own thing and we played foot golf while other golfers were playing the traditional sport. And no one minded, you know, we were just all out there having fun.
Well, you're obviously somebody who loves the game. I'll be honest, I've done mini golf. I've never been out on a proper green. Can you just share the appeal? What is it you love about getting out and golfing?
Oh, there's something about being outside and, you know, having that challenge of hitting a small white ball into a hole, you know, and just kind of it mirrors life in a lot of ways in that not all bounces are going to go your way, even if you hit the perfect shot. But, you know, you just kind of have to go on and hit the next shot and try to figure it out from there. You can't dwell on the past or fear the future and just kind of stay in the moment. You know, I've played a lot of sports in my life, and golf is definitely the one that has taught me most lessons and keeps me grounded in many ways. You know, a lot of people say that golf is their escape, but more and more now, especially, you know, people my age, millennials and stuff like that, we can't really afford to unplug, you know, for 4 or 5 hours and just totally ignore our phones. And so more and more now you see that golf courses and you know, professionals who work at golf courses are accepting the idea that cell phones are allowed on the course. And so I'm, you know, more than able to keep up with my life and not, you know, completely ignore my surroundings because I can't afford to do that for 5 hours. But at the same time, I can completely just relax and, you know, channel my energy into golf and, you know, focus on the game at hand. So it's really awesome.
I've got a pretty strong hunch that if I were to go out and try it, I would be very bad at golfing at first. Could you, if I were to give it a shot, how would you recommend I get started?
Definitely on the range with a teacher. I think a mistake a lot of people make is that they look at the pros play and think, oh, golf swing, that's easy, I'll make contact, you know. But a lot of times those first few swings that you take, the first several swings you take, you'll miss the ball, you know, and that's okay. You know, that's all part of the process. So I would definitely recommend, you know, taking a 30-minute, just very kind of basic lesson at a driving range, where a teacher can teach you how to kind of grip the club and how to swing and what to think about. And then from there, after a few sessions on the driving range, not every single one of them has to be with a teacher, then go out and play a hole or two, if you're lucky enough to have that access to kind of just be able to play a hole or two if a friend of yours is a big golf nut or is a member somewhere and you can tag along, or play nine holes. A lot of golf courses offer nine hole rates, and it's the perfect kind of amount of time and the perfect challenge. So I would definitely start on the range.
And I would allow no cameras, no witnesses at all to those first efforts.
Well, the thing to remember is that everyone goes through that. You know, it's just part of the game. There's no need to be embarrassed.
We're talking with Golf Digest editor Ashley Mayo about the challenges facing golf. She says it's alive and well, despite some media reports, and what changes could maybe help bring new people into it, and just the love of the game in general. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
And golfers, do you think the sport is still as popular as it once was? Is there anything that you think needs to change to bring back a popularity of golf? And what do you think could convince people who've stopped playing to start playing golf again? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the future of golf. Some media reports have said it's on the decline, maybe on the way out. Our guest, a lover of golf, says not so fast. It's alive and well. Still a lot of people interested. And some slight changes could help bring even more people into the sport.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you love about the sport of golf? And do you think that love has been communicated to the next generation of golfers? How does that happen? Are you worried about golf, or do you think it's doing just fine? Call us at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our guest, Ashley Mayo, stays with us. She's senior editor at Golf Digest magazine.
I'll go right to our callers now. Sandy is with us in Bloomer. Sandy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I think the cost is what's driven a lot of golfers away. Like, at local courses, if you'd offer family packages or get these kids at a lower rate, that would get them interested, and then they would continue on. It's a great exercise for the whole family. I just think cost has driven a lot of people away.
Sandy, thanks for the call. We also heard from James on Facebook, who says making golf less expensive would make it more popular with him. Ashley, is that a concern that a lot of people look at golf and say, hey, the financial barrier to entry is just too high for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no denying that golf, between the, you know, greens fees and the golf equipment and just all the gear that you have to buy, can be quite expensive. It doesn't have to be, though. You know, there are a lot of municipal golf courses that offer resident rates, you know, so discounts, major discounts for residents, and twilight rates as well. So after 2 or 3 p.m., greens fees go way down in price. And, you know, a lot of these kind of resort-friendly or resort golf courses are family-friendly. And by family-friendly, I mean they have, you know, those set of tees that are in the fairway, but also breaks in price for greens fees for, you know, children. So it does exist. It's unfortunate that not all golf courses offer it, but it does exist out there. And, yes, I totally agree that there needs to be more of that.
Here's maybe a dumb question. If I show up, can I rent the gear there, or do I have to show up with my full set of clubs?
You can rent gear at a lot of golf courses.
All right. Back to our callers now. We've got Sam on the line in Winona, Minnesota. Sam, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I started playing golf about a month ago.
Huh.
And I actually am a tennis player, and it's been quite interesting. It's really hard to it's really a hard sport, but if you give it time, you'll learn to love it.
So yeah, you say it's a hard sport, Sam, but you're sticking with it. You think it'll pay off if you get through that initial learning curve?
I think it definitely will.
I agree, Sam. Stick with it. you know, there's no other sport is played on such a beautiful stage. You know, you get a golf course is just kind of an art form that you can walk into. And so it's really beautiful.
All right, Sam, good luck with your game. We'll go to Aaron in Madison now. Aaron, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Great to be on the air.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm actually on my way to play 9 holes right now.
Nice.
Right.
I'm fitting it in. I'm a graduate student. I don't have a lot of, extra money, but I use golf as my reward for accomplishing things during the week. And
great.
I look for deals.
All right. Erin, thank you so much for the call. And have a good, 9 holes, she said. Yeah, some of the comments I've seen on the articles that kind of kicked off this conversation, Ashley, is that maybe golf doesn't appeal to young people. They don't have the attention span. But maybe, as Erin says, it's a way to get away from what you're doing, reward yourself, and take time to do something and devote yourself to getting better at something.
Exactly. And, you know, Aaron's playing 9 holes, and that'll take 2 hours. And 2 hours is what a movie takes, you know. And so we all can fit in a 2-hour chunk of time here and there. So, you know, that's not impossible. It's not crazy. 18 holes is borderline crazy for some people, especially for people like Aaron, who's a graduate student, very busy, you know, studying all the time. But those 2 hours to just unplug and forget about life and focus on a new challenge is a really kind of powerful way to recharge the batteries.
Aaron, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ashley, we talked some about bringing a new generation into the sport. Are there a lot of schools that have golf teams?
Oh, sure. Yeah, a lot of high schools and colleges have colleges have the kind of college teams that travel the country, but also club teams. So, you know, you get that. And then high schools, of course, have high school golf teams. You know, I was a product of my high school golf team where I played with the boys, but then started a girls team. Now they have a great girls team. And then also in college. And it's, very common.
How much does the appeal of golf to the public ebb and flow with having a star golfer out there? I imagine a lot of people maybe came into the sport inspired by Tiger Woods. Does that help or hurt the game over time?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, every sport kind of thrives when you get that one superstar, you know, with whether it was Michael Jordan basketball and how much interest he generated there, or Andre Agassi with American tennis and, you know, how much he kind of ignited Americans' interest in tennis. Tiger did the same for golf. But so is Ricky Fowler. You know, he's getting a lot of people interested in making it look cool. And so, yes, having that kind of superstar in golf would definitely help kind of make golf tug at the heartstrings of kind of millennials and get them interested in golf. And we're seeing that a lot with not only Tiger, but with also Ricky and like a Jordan Spieth, who's very kind of emotional on the golf course and just, you know, you need that kind of connection. So yes, absolutely.
All right. We'll take one more caller. We've got Jason on the line in Oak Creek. Jason, hi.
Hi. Yeah, love the game. It's always beautiful out there. The courses that I play at, public, private, they could use more traffic. They need more money to get the greens up to, you know, spuff, you know, and get, you know, the soccer idea is great. You know, brings more people out to the golf course to enjoy their time. You know, and it, as long as you're patient with the game, patient with yourself and the other people, you know, out there on the course, you know, you let them play through or whatever, you strike up a little chat, you learn a little bit about people that you may not normally have done.
All right, Jason, I want to give Ashley a chance to respond to that. Thank you so much for the call, Jason. Golfing is a social activity, Ashley.
Yeah, and that's another kind of thing that people overlook a lot is that more golfers would play more if they had more people to play with. And we're seeing now apps and websites designed to kind of help golfers find golfers in their area and, you know, build their little golf network. Absolutely, golf is totally a social sport. You can show up to a golf course as a single and get paired up randomly with people, but a lot of times people would rather, you know, spend those hours with their friends or with people who they know before they show up to a golf course. So getting people to find other golfers in their area is huge.
Ashley, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Ashley Mayo. She is senior editor at Golf Digest magazine. Joined us to talk about the future of golf, some possible changes that could be coming to game, and just share her love of it, too.
Well, something else happening today. It is worldwide Handshake Day, National Handshake Day, a worldwide effort to up our handshake game. It's an effort to get us to recognize the importance and history of the handshake and, I guess, to get us to shake someone's hand.
Yeah, someone that we wouldn't usually shake the hand of. So we put it to the test earlier. We shook hands in our office.
Which we've never done.
I don't think, I can't recall an occasion where we would have shaken hands.
It was okay.
It was, I don't know, a little awkward. I mean, you know, we didn't really have a lot of cause to shake hands at that point.
I think the handshake is preferable to the cheek kiss,
yeah,
which I try to avoid at all costs.
Better a polite nod, we were talking fist bumps. Our producer Amanda Magnus was making a case for completely replacing the handshake with the fist bump. I don't know. I'm not germ phobic exactly, but it seems like making handshaking or kissing a thing. I mean, it's just asking to spread germs. Am right. I a bad person to worry about that?
Yes,
probably.
Yes, you are.
So what do you think? Are you a handshaker, a cheek kisser, or would you prefer to do away with both customs? What would you replace it with? Send us an email. How about centraltime@wpr.org? That's centraltime@wpr.org. Maybe we'll share it on a future show even.
Well, coming up next, we look at some new science that says it's true, Google is destroying our memory. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.